So we are now recording to the cloud, and welcome all to those who have stayed on for Q&A or joined us late for Q&A. And we do have quite a bit of material. Alan, you said your connection was stable. Did you want me to present it, or do you want to take over?
No, I'm up to.
Your audio is breaking up, so I guess I should. Okay, let me just see. I got, okay. Let me share that. Share. Okay, so. Here we go, and so we'll head right into it. So this, the follow-up, Alan did that. Thank you, Alan. Otherwise, we would, again, not be recording the audio. So follow-up to last week, or actually this is a follow-up to quite a while ago, at January 27th Q&A. I had some slides on there on troubleshooting Windows Update, and one of the slides I had there was the nuclear option, which basically deletes two folders that are in underneath the Windows folder on your computer. The problem with deleting them is that you can't delete them while a couple of the services are running that use those folders. Those folders are used to track what's going on with Windows Update. And if you ever get an error with Windows Update that, you know, some update couldn't be installed, and they say you could try again later on, or, you know, some advice might say reboot your computer and try again to do the update, and you keep getting the error, I actually do recommend the two other options before the nuclear option. And the first is that you actually go to the Windows troubleshooting. There is a troubleshooter for Windows Update. It will check a couple of things, like the services that are required to do it. Are they running and functioning properly and things like that. The other one is to run disk cleanup and then choose the system files option. And there's an option there to delete old Windows Update material. Now, in recent versions of Windows, it cleans itself up pretty well, but older versions of Windows 10, it could collect a lot of information in there. Running that option could take half an hour to clear out on your computer. I don't know what it's doing through that whole process. It seems to be faster now. But if those don't work, the nuclear option has always worked for me, and it has no real downside to it. So the problem really comes down to the idea that how do you delete the directories if there are services that are not letting you delete them even as administrator. So the solution is to run a script that stops the services and then restarts the deletes the folders and then restarts the services. And it all happens in a script quickly enough that the services that are set to start automatically don't start in time before the folders are actually deleted. So going from the top, we just have a command or a reminder to run as administrator. They are under the Windows directory. You can't delete them as a regular user. Then it goes into getting rid of backup folders, because what I do, rather than deleting them, I just rename them so that worst case scenario, I could rename them back and I'd be back to the same situation I was in. But I have never actually needed those backup folders. So I do a remove directory on the backups so that if I ran this before, it gets rid of those ones. Then it stops four services. Then it renames the, and I say corrupted folders, I don't know what it is, but it deletes those folders. They will get recreated when the services restart up and things start happening with the Windows Update, it'll automatically create the directories. So I just rename something else, the .olds, restart the services, and then I just put up a reminder to make sure that there were no errors. So what you're looking for in particular there is when it tries to rename those corrupted folders or renames the folders to .old, was there an error on that? If there was an error message that came up on screen, then you have to redo the process. After that, go to Windows Update and do check for updates. If it still doesn't work, I would try reboot, run this script again as an administrator, and then I would probably do another reboot and then try again. I've never had it fail at that point, and Alan had a friend who He had some problems with it, but when he ran it as a script like this, it eventually did work properly for him. So if you're having problems with Windows Update, that's what I actually recommend. And just as a humorous follow-on to this, this is Mark Rusinovich, who's the CTO of Microsoft Azure, posted this on Twitter the other day. Troubleshooting steps we all go through when we're trying to solve problems. The first thing is you say, no, that can't happen. And then you say, well, it doesn't happen on my machine. And then you say, well, it's not supposed to happen. Then, oh, I wonder why that happens. Oh, I see. I wonder how that ever worked. So just a little bit of a humorous take on troubleshooting. We all are in denial for about half of troubleshooting. Okay, we are now going to enjoy a Microsoft Access presentation from Stefan. And so, Stefan, I think you can go ahead. I'll do a stop share, but you can go ahead and do a share on your screen and take it away.
Great. There we go.
Yep, we see it.
Okay. So first, what is Microsoft Access? Microsoft Access is a database management system. This may not tell you a whole lot more. So the database management system is a software package designed to define, manipulate, retrieve, and manage data in a database. A DBMS generally manipulates the data itself, the data format, field name, record structure, and file structure. It also defines the rules to validate and manipulate this data. And I will show you how you can do all of these things with Access. Access has a graphical user interface and software development tool. It's all integrated in one software, so that's very good for that. It's a member of the Microsoft 365 family or personal suite subscription, or it's sold separately as a standalone piece of software. It also uses something called Visual Basic for Application, VBA. It's an object-based programming language that can reference a variety of objects. It's not only used in Access, most of the software suite in the Microsoft, the old Microsoft Office, like in Word, PowerPoint, Excel, use the same VBA. It's just the object are different. There's an object for Excel. There's an object for Access that you can use. So why did I start using Access or become interested with that? Many years ago, my wife had a home daycare, and for income tax purpose, we needed to keep track of various type of expense, like the daycare supplies, the food we're giving the kid, the house expense, the vehicle expense, and the income she was getting. So for the first year of operation, we used the shoebox method. We put all of the receipt in a shoebox and gave it to an accountant. But we had no visibility on really are we going to get a big bill when it's tax time or not. So I had to develop a system to help my wife keep track of all of that information. I started for many years. I used a very complex Excel spreadsheet with many sheets depending on what type of expense or income I wanted to keep track. But there was many problems. There was data entry inconsistencies. Adding a child or an expense category was not automated. I had to change many formula or modify or add sheets to make it work. The report, and especially if my wife wanted a custom report, were not good. And the tax receipts were handmade. And I had a spreadsheet for each fiscal year. So when we were starting a new fiscal year, I had to clean up that spreadsheet and keep the information that was moving from year to year. So after doing that a number of years, I decided to look into building an Access database. In Access, you have forms that answer the data that you enter is entered consistently and made the navigation of the application easy. So you can do both things with forms. This is a snapshot of the application that I did for my wife. It's in French, not French, but English. So you can select the year that you want the report for. If you click on revenue, which is for income, you get to a form that you enter the information. I can support multiple years in a single database. It was easy to use for my wife. She was able to enter income and expense. This is an example of the form that she used to enter an income. First, she was picking the child from the pick list, and automatically the rate for that child was appearing in the box that says coût, the day that you're entering that information, what period you're covering, and the number of days was calculated automatically between the start date and the end date, and was figuring the amount of income that you got for that daycare. She could put a note, and also determining we can, on the income tax, we can claim the meals, the cost of the meal we give to the children. She was doing that also. And she could generate various reports, like, for example, oh, how much, like sometimes the parents ask, how much I've paid at daycare up to now. So she had a report that I created for her. She just clicked on it, and she was getting the information right away. The tax receipts were generated. She has to do just file print and sign them. Obviously, it requires some work to do the design and implement the database, but the ease of use paid off over the years, as we have been using that database probably for easily 10 years. So when you want to create a database in Access, when you do a file new, you get a choice of either creating a blank database or to use a template. And there is a lot of templates already built in Access. So I made a list on the right, and there is many more of that. If you don't find what you're looking for as in terms of a template, you can search the internet and you will find websites that are either free or will sell you a template. And when you select a template, Access will work and it will create all the various table, queries, form, report, and we'll talk about those later on. So if you decide to use a template, you can use it as is, or if you say, yeah, this one is close to what I need, but I would like to be able to modify it, or obviously if you want to create your own database, you need to understand the type of objects or the where the information is in Access, or is it being done, basically. So the first one is called a table, and I show the icon there. And this is where you define your data and where the data will be stored. The other type of objects that you can have are queries. And I show the most common icon, but depending on the type of query, the icon will change slightly. So what is a query? You can define a custom view and where you can do a search, you can do a count of some things, you can do the sum of things, of data from one or more table or queries. So you can build queries that use queries, or you can build queries that use a mix of table and queries, or you can use a query that just use one table. The next thing you can build, the next type of objects are called forms, and this is the most common icon for that. And you use form for data input, or to display data, or to control the application execution, like in a menu if you want, like I show you for my wife, the first thing was done with a form. Reports, this is the icon for the reports. Basically, it's for formatting, calculating, printing, and summarize selected data. And again, most reports are using a query. So you select the field that you want, and after that you can format them using the report objects. The next object you can do are called macro, and basically this is a structured definition of one or more action that you want Access to do or to perform in response to a defined event. And most things are, that can happen where you're doing something are called an event. Like, for example, if you're creating a new record, there's an event that is triggered, and you can ask Access to do certain things, like to verify that something exists or doesn't exist, that kind of things. But the macro is quite, you can do the basic function. If you want to do some serious stuff, you need to use what we call a module. And these are custom processing, and you code that using the Visual Basic for application. Now I will take you to, I will show you example and what each of these objects one by one, so you have a better understanding and what they look like and what you can do with them. So the first one are table. Tables contain fields or columns, and they store different kind of data. So there is, you pick the data type that you want for that column, and after that, Access will make sure that you can only use that data type in that column. For example, you can store a name, an address, a number, whatever you pick. And record are basically rows that you collect the information about that particular instance of the subject. For example, if you're creating a table that you want to keep track of employee information, you're going to define the fields or the columns that you want to keep track, and after that, you're going to start entering data for each of the employees. Each field must have a unique name within that table, and you need to pick a data type. And you can tell Access if that field is going to be required. So in order to save the record, does the field need to have data, or you can leave it optional. Basically, you can save it with not data in it. So depending on what you want to achieve, this becomes important. Access 2019 has 13 data types. So you can, for example, select a data type that you want to store a number, and within the number, there's a number of option that you can select. You can pick text, and in the text, there's two types, like a short text that is up to 256 character, or a long text. You can store a gigabyte of information. There is date and time that are combined, and there is many more type. You can store pictures, URL, embedded objects, all kinds of stuff. You can define also, when you create your table, a primary key. So it's going to be one or more fields that will have a unique value for each of the record. So this becomes useful when you're trying to keep track of things. And like, I don't know if you noticed, when I showed the income form for my wife, the first thing at the top was a revenue ID. So this is why I was able to keep track what revenue we're talking about. You can also define one or more indexes on each of the table or the field, and this helps you or help Access to retrieve the information more quickly. So here's a few examples. So this is a screenshot from Access, and as you can see, there is the header table on the left here, and you can have many tables. There's not really a limit. I think there's a limit, but I think it's something like 1,000 tables. So you will have to be a pretty big database. And what the table itself, when you look at it, it looks almost like a spreadsheet, but it's something that make it different from a spreadsheet is that small plus sign. When you create the table in the field, you can begin to create relationship between these tables. And there is, if you created a relationship, when you click on a small plus sign, it will open and it will show you all the other records that are being linked to that specific record. That's probably the biggest difference between Access and, if you want, Excel in terms of the data. On the top left, you have an icon there that says View. If you click on that, what it will do, instead of showing the data, it will show you the design of the table. So it looks something like this. So you see the same field that we have on the left. You see them reproduced there, the same names, or whatever you type there will be the name of the column. And you can see the data type, and you can see there's different things you can use, like the supplier ID is a number, the ID itself is an auto number. This is a special data type in Access that is going to be a number that increments automatically and will never be used again. So if you erase that record, Access will not use that number again. And you can have various other things. And for each of these fields at the bottom, you get more properties. Like if you're selecting, for example, a number on the property tab at the bottom, you get to choose a field size. Like for example, is that number is going to be a long integer, a short integer, or a double, a floating point? So you can select all of that information. You can see almost at the bottom of the line here, you can see required. I put down no. So basically, you're telling Access, people don't need to fill out that number. If you put a yes, in order to save the record, Access will want to see a number there. Now, talking about queries, by the way, there is a lot more information on each of these topics. I'm just giving you a brief overview on what it looks like, basically. Talking about queries. So queries are a way of searching for and compiling data from one or more table or other queries. Running a query is like asking a detailed question of your database. When you build a query in Access, you are defining specific search conditions to find exactly the data you want. In Access, you can use the graphical query by example facility. I will show you an example of that. Or you can write the SQL, the structured query language. It's a language that has been defined. It's a text language that you can type basically what you want the query to do, statement to create your query. So you can do either one. And if you are in the graphical query by example, there is you can click on a button and it will show you what the SQL statement look like. You can define query to select, basically, so you can select fields that you want to display, and or you can do queries that will update. For example, if you have many records that you want to change that number and increase it by 30%, you can write a query that will select all of these records. You can identify what criteria you want to use and what do you want to update. You can create queries that will insert new record, or you can create queries that will delete data. You can also define queries that will create new table from data in one or more existing table. So we'll look at a couple of examples of these things. So you can see on the left, there's the heading queries, and below that there is a list of queries. And as the same thing as the table, you can get as many queries as you want. There is a limit, but it's very high. And when you look at it, it looks very similar to a table, but it's generated on the fly. So when you run the query, Excel go get the fields that you selected and when you define the query and it display them. If you click on so this is, like I said, there is many of, you can define as many query as you want, and the query can call queries also. If you click on the design view, you get this view basically, and on this one it shows for the inventory query all the various tables that have been used and the relationship that were created between these tables. And towards the bottom of the screen, you can see a row called field. So you can click a field from one of the table and drag it at the bottom there, and it will show up. So you can see product ID was renamed ID. So there is, the ID was renamed as product ID. And when you look at the first column on the left there, you see that it's product ID, product name. So it's the same, very similar to the table definition, but you pick the field that you want in the query. You can select a sort if you want to sort the data in a particular order, because one of the rules in when you do database, normally they don't sort the data. They will just present them where all they store on the disk, which cannot be in order that you want. So if you want them in a specific things, you use a query and you can specify the sort order that you're looking for. The show indicators will, if it will show as a column in the query. The criteria, this is when you can say, oh, I want to see all of the product ID that are bigger than whatever or contains this string or something like that, depending on the data type.
Yes, uh-huh.
Here you are. Uh-huh. Yes?
Greg is asking, can we see the merge key variable in design view?
Say that again? Yes. No, when it's in design view, you need to click it here. You have the run button. When you click on that here, it will show you the result of the query. So is this answering the question?
I just wanted to know if visually, I assume that you use ID to merge like between products and inventory sold. But then, okay, and you probably use product ID to merge InVarity sold to InVarity on hold. But like, is there a visual design, a visual aspect that, because the screen is a bit small for me, so I was just wondering, is it possible to see what's being used to do the merges? Those are merges. Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm confusing stuff.
Okay. So, and if you click on here, on that view button here, you get many options. One of them will be the SQL that I mentioned, and if I want to see the SQL statement that is equivalent to that, these table that we see here and stuff like that, it looks something like this. So you can see stuff with the select, because it's a select statement, and all of these things define the various fields, where they come from. So there's a lot of, that's why it's much easier to use this. It's visual. You don't need to type a whole lot of things. If you want to type the SQL statement, there's a lot of typing. And if you make a mistake, Access will tell you, I don't recognize that field name. So you need to go back and correct it. If it's visual, that you just drag the field at the bottom, it's much easier to use. Talking now about forms. So forms are used for entering, modifying, or viewing record. You can, when you open a form, you can tell Access to open it in the data entry. So you will not show you the existing record, just a blank record. You can begin right away to enter, or you can ask Access to open the same form, but open it in the edit mode. So they will show you all of the record that are in that table, so you can modify them. The form can also be used to control the application. So like the menu that I did for my wife, so it's easy for her to find out, okay, I need to run a report. She goes in the report section, and these open a form that give you maybe a list of reports and stuff like that. Forms are used to customize the presentation of data that your application extracts from the query and table. I will show you an example of that. The reason that forms are used so often is that they are an easy way to guide people toward entering the data correctly. And this goes back to the table. When you select a specific data type, if you say in for that column or that field, I want to put a number, don't try to put text, don't try to put a date, don't try to put other things. Access will reject it and say, no, I want a number in that field. So this is when you get data consistencies. When you enter the information in an Access, informing Access, the data goes exactly where the database designer wanted to go in one or more related table. The form themselves are made of controls, and Access has 22 controls, such as one that you can display a label, I'll show you an example of that, a text box, a drop-down box, list box, checkbox, subform, graphic. There's 22 of them that you can use. And it's basically all of the control that you see in most Windows applications, it will look very familiar to you. So here's an example of a form. So this is a form that is called Employee Details. So you can see that it has tabs at the top here. So when you run out of real estate, you can begin to create new tabs and put other and like more fields into these other tabs. Most likely, this comes from an employee table that you have defined these fields and information they need to collect. And if you had to put information or in the field or not in order to save it, you can put the pictures, email, URL. If you click on that, you will go and open that page. This one, just because of the size of the box, I suspect that they use a longer text, so you can put a lot of text there. At the bottom there, this is a navigation bar that when you configure the form that you can have display, you can turn it off, but most of the time you leave it on. It tells you how many records there is, like in that for that table, and there is a 9 record, and we are at record 1. And you can use the navigation button here, like this one bring you to the first record. This one goes the previous record. It's gray out because we are the first record. This one bring you to the next record. So if I was going to click on this, I will go to record 2 of 9. If I click on this one, it goes to the end of the records. And if you click on this one, it will create a blank records, you can begin to enter new data. If I right-click on this form, I will get an option to say design. So it will show me the design of the form. So here, it's no longer, this is data if you want, but here is the design itself. So here you can see that it's a text box, and it's linked, it's bound with the first name field that come from most likely a table, and all of these are done the same way. And when you go to the design mode, there is a list of tools or the controls that appear, and these are all the various controls. So when you want them, you just click on it, like this is a text box, this is a label, this is a button, this is the control to do these tabs here. So when you click on them, you get a wizard that asks you a number of questions. Oh, what data do you want to use, and that kind of things, and you just follow the steps, and when you click OK, it will create it for you. And after that, you can, when it's in design mode like this, you can change the location of it, you can change the font, there's a lot of customization that you can do. Moving on to reports. You can view a report on your screen before you print it, or you can export it to PDF, Word, Excel, and many, many more other formats. There's a list of at least 10 that I recall. Forms are used for input, then report will be used for output. Anything you plan to print deserves a report. Whatever, it's a list of names and addresses, a financial summary for a period, a set of meaning labels. Reports are useful because they allow you to present components of your database in an easy-to-read format. You can even customize a report appearance to make it visually appealing, so you can change font, colors, that kind of stuff. Access offers you the ability to create a report from any table or queries. So we'll look at an example. As it's shown here, you can create as many reports as you want. Just pick at the monthly sales report. So when I double click on it, it basically goes and run the queries and it display the information. Give you the date here. This is the report for June 2006. You have the product name and the sales that were done for that product in that month, and it does a sum for the month of June. Here you will have an option to, if you click on that arrow here, you get an option to see the design of the report. So if I do that, I will get something that looks something like this. It's the same control that we use on the forms that are available on the report. Like this one here is basically a label, so it just basically shows as is. But when you go into the details here, it's the name of the field that it goes and reports, cell group fields, and it's going to repeat that row for each. It will repeat this formatting for each of the rows that you find in the database. And you can also control the sorting of these things. The reports are really, really powerful to display information. And again, you get the same toolbar that give you access to the same list of control that you had access on the forms. Now, if we look at the macro, so, for example, if you want to create a button on your form that open a report, you could use a macro which will fire the open report action. You can include a simple condition in macro to specify when or more action in a macro should be performed or skipped. You can use macro to open and execute a queries, open table, or print of your reports. You can also run other macros or Visual Basic within a macro. You can attach data macro. So these are simpler macro. You don't have access to all of the action, a subset of them, but you can attach them to a table. For example, if you're inserting a new record or deleting a record, you can attach a macro and you can do more things. Again, you can get many macros, and if you right-click on it, you can either run it. If you do right-click exit, it will show you the contain of the macro itself, and it will help you if you want to code it. For example, you go into the action catalog. If you click on that, you get a list of action that you can, you basically, okay, I would like to do some data entry operations. You can click on this and you will get a number of action. And when you find the exact action that you want to do, you say, okay, that's what I want to do. You click on it and it will appear here on the list of macro, and you can make it execute. Like, for example, this one, if the current project is trusted, open form, and the form name is startup screen, and the view, you can have a number of options, form view, or it will be, like, for example, design. Filter, you can, when you open the form, you may want to filter the data to only show certain record. So basically, it will hold your hand, giving you all the various things that you need to input to make it work.
Stefan, another question. Greg's asking, are there loops in the action catalog? So like do while or for next?
It may not be available, so that's why macro are quite limited on what you can do. You can do a branch of action, but probably loop may not be available. I don't use macro a lot. I prefer to use VBA, what I will show you in a minute. So moving on to module. So module provide a more discrete flow of action and allow you to trap errors, which you cannot do using a macro. It gives you more flexibility to do things also. Everything that can be done in a macro can be done in a module, but you don't get the macro interface that prompts you what is needed for each of the actions. So you need to know a little bit more about the objects within Access to use VBA, but you can do a whole lot more magic. Modules are far more powerful and are essential if you plan to write code with error handling or use object libraries such as the Excel objects. I was able to, I had some data that was in a spreadsheet, and I was able to, using objects in VBA, open the Excel spreadsheet and navigate to that specific cell and get that data back in the Access database. So it's very powerful.
Stefan, there was a question from Claudette along the same lines, and I guess she was thinking more simply, can you copy and paste information from an Excel or Word table to access to an Access table and vice versa?
Yes, it's easy. If you select, if you click here, it will select all the record in that view. And you can do right-click copy, and you can go in Excel and do paste. And it will paste all of that information, including the header for the fields and stuff like that. Going from Excel to Access, it's a bit more complicated because the data type need to match what Access is expecting. If you start with a blank table and you don't define any field, it will just create all the fields as text, and it will accept all the data. But if you want to import numbers and stuff like that, it's probably better to create your table and manipulate your data in Excel to make sure that they match. And when you select them, you can do copy and paste. And if Access, because you can paste like hundreds, thousands of rows, it will, if you find mistakes, it will tell you, and it will create a table called a paste error. So you will be able to figure out which rows or what information Access didn't like when you tried to paste it into the table.
One thing you can do if you're trying to go from Access to Excel, you can actually open up an Access database right from within Excel, and it'll bring up the list of the tables you have. You just select one of the tables, it'll say where do you want to put it, and it'll create a spreadsheet for you from a table directly.
maybe to add to this, and this is where I'm not sure. In Excel, there are regular like sheets, and then there are sheets or columns, and where it's treated as data and as data tables. I think I'm not sure of the right wording used by in Excel, and I believe that if you would change it in Excel, it would immediately update in Access. But I'm not sure here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, if you have it linked as a data source, yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's the wording. Yeah.
So, module can be a standalone object containing function that can be called from anywhere in your application, or they can be directly associated with a form or a report to respond to event on the associated form or report. Like, for example, when Access opens a form, there's a number of events that are being triggered. I'm going to run this on memory, probably get it wrong, but something like load, open, current. So depending at what stage you want to do something, there is very, on the form, there is easily 25 events that you can trap and ask Access to do something. So give you one example. So when you right-click on one of the module, you get a view that looks something like this. It's basically code, but you can see that it put in blue the things that it's part of the Visual Basic language. This is an example how you can define a variable, and this is basically code. This option here, option explicit, force, if you don't define all the variables you're going to be using, it will give you an error. So this will allow you to make sure that you don't try to put text into a number or vice versa. So you can do a basic database without using macro and VBA, but you want to do something like a lot of data manipulation, you probably need to go and use some of the VBA code, but it's depending what you want to do. I was talking about objects, so if you go into the tool here, you can have a reference, and that window here will pop up, and you can select basically which library that you want to get access. So on this one, there is the Visual Basic for application, basically is the VBA itself. But I use the Microsoft Office Access Database Engine Objects Babel. That's probably give you access to play with a record in the database. But as you can see, there's a whole lot of objects that you can use. And just look at the size of the scroll bar here. I didn't count them, but I'm pretty sure there is 100 of these libraries that are available. Especially when you go towards the M letter, like Microsoft, you get like Microsoft Excel, you get, Microsoft Excel, you get Microsoft Word, Microsoft PowerPoint. A couple of years ago, I was trying to do something strange with an object, and I was not able to access, did not have that object I wanted to do, but PowerPoint add the objects. So I did a search on the internet how to do that. I was able to, within Access, to create a PowerPoint presentation, create the objects I wanted to do, and after that, get an image of that and put it back in my Access database. So it's very powerful. It's just I use the internet a lot, Google, to figure out things when I want to do something.
Stefan, Greg is asking if there are different flavors of SQL in that list of references.
No, they call it SQL is pretty standard. There's slight variation, but if you go on the internet and you just put Access SQL, it will give you all the various, like the format that you need to use, and there's a lot of documentation that help you. And if you use the query by example, you don't really need to know SQL. It's just if you begin to do queries in code that you need to know, because you will have to write the SQL text to do.
Okay.
I think it's back to you, Chris.
Yeah, so we've got a poll that we're going to run here, and let me just bring it up. And so, Stefan, thank you very much for your presentation. And he's willing to give more information on each of the access object types if people are interested. So there is a poll on the screen. If you are interested in any of those, vote in on it. And Stefan would be happy to give a presentation on any or all of those at future Q&A sessions. I presume everybody sees the poll. There, I finally see a vote. So one for macros, I see. And I see one for forms. I see one for none of the above. I have one for modules. I have a second for forms. So as it stands so far we've got two for forms, two for macros, two for modules, another one for forms, another one for tables. So it looks like there is some interest out there so far for everything except for queries and reports. But what I'll do is I'll leave that on screen for a little bit longer, and I will capture the numbers afterwards and get them over to you, Stefan. So
okay.
If you want to put together something on that. So I'll leave it for another, it's 1.5 minutes. I'll leave it up for another half a minute for people to vote in if they're interested. I think I can leave that running while I continue on with yep.
Sorry, excuse me. I have a question. When you were showing the part on forms, and there was a grid. Is it a bit like PowerPoint when you drag and drop the different boxes? Like, is it like sort of if you already have one box in the X axis, will it try to sort of anchor it at the same place in terms of the X axis?
In Access 2019, Microsoft created a grid that you can put the control in them. It's much easier to align things.
Okay.
In the previous version of Access, it was not the case. And it was always a major pain to get all of these boxes to line up and stuff like that properly. It was sometimes I can making the change on the table to add a new field could take me like 20 seconds, but to modify the form because that new field need to go here, so I need to move all of these guys down. And all the spacing is wrong, so I was passing more time playing with that than to. Then making the change to the database. But now in Access 2019, they have that a new function that make that much, much easier. It does exactly what you're describing. As soon as you put you select a field and you drag it, if you need space, you will insert it, and it's wonderful.
Okay, so we've got some more material to go, so I think we should cut it off there. So thanks very much, Stefan, for that presentation, a whirlwind tour of Access, and it looks like there is some interest, certainly in terms of looking at some of the other things in the future. So I've got that information captured, and I'll pass that on to you afterwards as well.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll go back to our deck. And if I find the right one, there we go. So Alan has a share for us on Audacity. So Alan, let me know when you want me to advance slides.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Chris. We had a question or a request, I guess, for some information on Audacity, and I've used it a little bit in the past, so I can give you a quick overview of it. It's essentially an open source program, so it's completely free. It's also cross-platform, as you'll see in a minute, and it's really for audio recording and editing. Next, please.
Yep, sorry, just, there we go.
No, my screen hasn't updated yet. Oh, great. There we go. So cross-platform. So I use it because there's a version for Windows, as you can see highlighted there. The latest version is 3.0.2, but it also has a version for Linux, so I can use it on both of my operating systems. And if you're a Mac user, then there's a version for macOS as well. Next.
Yeah, I guess slow updating on you.
No. It really is.
It is now saying on my screen, install the blank canvas.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to bring up the... Yeah, so when you install it, as it says, it installs a blank canvas. So you're starting from scratch. Okay, next slide, please, Chris.
Okay, so it's up. Settings all important.
Yeah, so the really important thing when you're running the program is to get the settings correct for the input and the output. And these are the settings that I'm currently using on my Windows machine. And it likes this MME, the Microsoft Multimedia Environment. And if you have a choice on input, anything that says mix seems to be the right thing. On my system, I have a Realtek stereo card, sound card. So the stereo mix Realtek is the thing I want. I want option two, which is stereo. Option one is mono recording, which I think everybody uses stereo these days. And for the output, I use the speaker jack, which again is hooked into the sound card. So if you look on the internet, there's good information, good tutorials on how to drive Audacity, and it will give you some good information on how to make these settings correctly. But basically, you have to just play around with them until they work for you. Next one, Chris.
Okay, so it's on CBC Listen.
So, for example, if I were to go onto the web and look for the CBC music playlist and pick up on the Tempo program, and I can get the on-demand service and basically play music. So what I'd be interested now in is recording from the internet using Audacity. So next, Chris.
Okay.
So it's a pretty simple interface. It has the controls just like a regular kind of VCR player. If you hit the big red button there, then it will start the recording.
Sorry, I think I went too. Okay.
You didn't on my screen.
Okay, it's now showing Audacity with two blue waveforms.
So now that we've hit the start recording button, and now the two waveforms are showing, so those are the two stereo channels. The green bar at the top is showing us the levels, and if that goes into the red, then we might be getting distortion, so we need to play around with the levels a little bit. Next.
Okay.
And so here, you notice that the input volume, the little microphone icon, is set for 100%. But on the left-hand side, the level of the recording is actually fairly low. And for some reason, it's because it's hooked into the sound card. The output volume is only set at 20%. So if I increase that, Chris.
Okay.
If I increase that to 50% on the output volume, you see that I get a stronger signal that I'm recording. So again, you play around with the signals until you get something which is reasonable, sounds reasonable, loud enough, right, in other words, but without an incredible amount of noise on the system. Next.
Okay.
One of the things we get with Audacity is a whole raft of options. And you can see in the main menu here, there's the file edit menu. But you've also got a thing which does tracks and effects and analyze and tools. And if you go through some of these things, you'll find that the one I use a lot is the ability to cut sections of recording. So typically I'll trim the recording at the front end and the back end to shorten up the track that I'm dealing with. But you can also do things like if you're using a vinyl record, for example, and it's noisy, then you have this remove clicks option that tries to get rid of that noise from the vinyl record. And also fade in and fade out to crossfade between tracks, for example. And apparently it also has extensive macro and plug-in capabilities if you want to do all kinds of weird and wonderful things. Next.
Okay.
So here's an example of a YouTube video. So we're definitely collecting the sound off the internet. And this is a Black Dyke Mills band, brass band from England. So I'm making the recording here. Next.
Okay.
So here's my final recording, and we're looking at the front end of it. And you can see that because it's a YouTube video, it's got a number of slides early on, giving the title and the players and that kind of thing. But there's actually no sound. So there's a long lead in, which I don't really want. So I'd quite like to trim the front end of that blank sound. Next.
Okay.
So the way to do that is just click the mouse on the left-hand side, drag it to the right, let go, and I've essentially highlighted that specific portion of the recording which I want to get rid of. Next.
Okay.
So the way to do that is to hit the little scissors icon, or which is the cut function, or use Control and X, and that will delete the function, delete that selection rather. Next. And you can see now that I've actually cut down the lead in to that that soundtrack to basically half a second, which is kind of reasonable for me. And again.
Okay.
So I'm here now. All right. So now what I need to do is save the recording. Now, you would think that you would say that the option here is save project. So you'd think that's what you would probably use. But in fact, what that does is it saves a sound file as the original, usually large wave type file, and all any actions that you've taken on that sound file, any edits that you've made, are all saved in this big kind of project file. I don't want that. What I actually want is my sound. I want my track. So the thing to do is to export it, and you can export it in various ways. I usually use export as MP3 because that compresses the sound but still gives you pretty good quality. So if you go to the next slide, so if I export it, then I can choose a file. I can choose a location. I can browse to a folder, and then I can choose a file name. I've chosen Black Dyke Meditation. I'm saving it as an MP3 file. Next. And then it gives me the option, I could use the drop down on the MP3 files menu, and you can see I could save it as a whole bunch of things. I could save it as a WAV file, which is an uncompressed file, which is large, or I could save it as an OGG file, which is a Linux type of sound file. But typically, and you also see down there M4A, which is the sound format that we use for that Zoom uses to record the audio tracks for our Q&A sessions. But as I said, I normally just use MP3. So click on that. And it moves on to the next option, which is to enable metadata. So if you want, if we're on that slide, Chris.
Yep, we are.
if you want, you can enter some information here, which gets coded into the MP3 file and records things like the artist's name and the genre of the music and that kind of thing. Typically, I don't bother with that kind of stuff, but you can if you wish. So you save the file, and on the next slide, you should see that I now have a sound file called Black Dyke Meditation. And if we go to the next slide, there's a couple of articles from past newsletters. One is talking about copying vinyl to CD. So vinyl records to CD, equally vinyl records to the computer or to a USB flash drive, for less than $5. Basically, the cost of a Y adapter to convert the output from my hi-fi amplifier, which is two connections for both channels, to a single stereo, mini stereo jack that fits into the sound card. So that costs just less than $5. And then the rest of the articles tell you how to do it. Actually using a different program called Wave Repair, but you could also use Audacity for the same thing. And the second article there, recording directly from the sound card, is a review of Audacity and pretty much along the lines that I've just talked about. So that's it for Audacity. That's the simple Audacity for dummies.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Okay, quickly to finish up, we don't have too much more, so let's carry on. We had a question from somebody trying to do a file transfer from an IBM XT. So we're talking about early 80s. They have actually, you can talk it through there, Alan.
It's actually a friend of mine. He has a slot car racing set, as you can see here. I think he wants to get rid of it. So if anybody's interested, drop me a line and I'll put you in touch. But the thing is, he has an electronic timing system which is running from an IBM XT. And it's using the printer port to connect to the various sensors. And then there's a counter on the wall there that does the display. But he's interested in getting rid of this system, but he'd quite like to retain the basic program. Now the problem is the XT has a 5.25 floppy, but he doesn't have a floppy drive reader, so he can't do a direct transfer to his Windows machine. So the question is, how can he do that? Anybody got any bright ideas?
Yeah, I know what he could do. Bring it up on the XT, take a picture of it, and then OCR it on his other computer.
Yeah, actually, if you notice here on this slide, I've actually got a screenshot. It's actually a hard copy printout of the program, which he tells me is complete. So that's certainly one thing he can do, is just scan those documents and do an OCR.
Yeah, that probably is going to be the easiest thing to do. I mean, I looked on the internet there. I came across some things, but I didn't validate them or anything like that. They tended to be really involved. They needed a null modem cable and, you know, special software like Laplink and things like that. So it didn't look like it was easy to transfer over. If he's got a printout, I would be willing to bet that OCRing it would be the fastest and easiest. He'd have to go in and check it and maybe correct some errors, but yeah, it should do the most of the job for him, I would think.
Well, the other thing is, if anybody has a 5.25 drive working, I'm sure he could get a disk to it and just make a printout or something. Or
yeah,
just transfer it to a USB stick. Anyway,
yeah,
that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Just a share from Eldon Gaw. The Dotto Tech has weekly webinars on Wednesday that you can sign up for. I went on the site to try to see past topics that they've had, but it seems like you have to actually create an account before you can see very much other than just signing up for the next one. Today's was on spring cleaning made easy, so how to spring clean your computer. Get the keyboard and get all the gunk out of your keyboard. And I think they had some advice on file management and things like that as well. So if anybody's interested in those, the URL is on the screen. And I presume that Alan will copy that into the chat window as well. So you might want to check that out to see what he has to offer. Then we had a question on Wi-Fi 6 mesh. Alan, do you want to talk to this?
Yeah, I guess. This was from Stefan.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
If anybody's using this specific Asus Zen Wi-Fi AX XT8 mesh. PC Magazine apparently ranked it as number one, and the link's there. He's questioning whether anybody has an opinion, but then as soon as he sent that, he sent me a follow-up and said, it may not be very good because the reviews on Amazon are not that great. So has anybody on the call here actually used this system?
So sounds like a no on that.
If
but
not, we had a, Chris and I had a question about whether Amazon reviews are the thing you should live by.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot recently in terms of advice that maybe you shouldn't trust online reviews, that some manufacturers will actually pay for people to go and create reviews, things like that. You know, how trustworthy are they? Amazon does have a verified purchase flag on it. So at least if you see a review, according to Amazon, that somebody who actually bought that product, and so presumably there's some weight on that. You know, a manufacturer is not going to go and buy 1,000 copies of their product from themselves just in order to have, you know, 1,000 different reviews on Amazon. So presumably verified purchase is worth something. One of the things that you'll find is that, you know, tech magazines, are they more trustworthy than, so say, an influencer or whatever who just promotes certain products? A lot of influencers, they're getting paid to, you know, promote a product or say what they think is great about it. You know, how trustworthy is that information? I don't know. Tech magazines may be a little bit more trustworthy, but they have their own biases as well. You have to question, do reviewers disclose if they actually got the product for free? And therefore, maybe their opinion is influenced by the fact that they got something for having discussed it or whatever. If they got the product free in return for a positive review, I've gotten offers through the Ottawa PC User Group quite frequently where people say, hey, we got a product. If you write a review on your website, you know, we'll give you a free copy of the software or whatever. You know, I'm not interested in that, but it happens. So I don't know if other people want to weigh in with what their opinion is on how to decide. Are you going to trust online reviews and what ones you find are trustworthy, or what are the flags you look to say that it's not trustworthy? It's an interesting question, so if anybody has anything to weigh in on.
Jocelyn has the answer, and he says, ask here, we are trustworthy.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's not a bad thing. Find, you know, a community of people that have a reputation of trustworthiness, that they're going to be honest about, you know, what they talk about. And certainly user groups, I think, are pretty good for that overall.
I often look at different online reviews, and if they all kind of tend to agree, then I find it reasonable. These are like technical magazines, for example.
Yeah. Bob, you had something?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I gave a presentation for the group on shopping online, and I covered the review reliability in several slides. So I'll dig those slides out, and maybe we can look at them at the next Q&A.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Because there are some issues. There's actually sort of gray area companies that their job is to come up with false, either negative or positive reviews for various manufacturers and other websites. And I cover that Amazon is probably more reliable. They actually have various techniques to weed out some of the false reviews. Canadian Tire discloses whether they gave you a consideration for doing the review, but again, their reviews tend to be less reliable. for various reasons. So I'll dig that out, and we can do it at a future Q&A.
Yep, let's do that as a follow-up. That'd be great, Bob. Thanks very much. Okay, let's. I think that's the last question that we have here. So were there any final comments on that, or we'll just leave it for future Q&A? We are 10 minutes over at this point. Okay, I'll take silence as let's move on and close it up. So just a reminder that Tech Cafe next Monday afternoon at 4 p.m., I will be giving an abbreviated version of the typography presentation I gave at the May meeting. I had 90 minutes there. I'll have less than an hour at Tech Cafe, so it will be somewhat abbreviated, but it will be basically the same idea. No extra content will be in there for sure. Reminder, the members' favorite, coming up September 8th, so after our summer hiatus, we will be having our members' favorite, and we're encouraging all to come forward with a mini presentation, 10 to 15 minutes each is what we generally aim for, and you will have a chance to win a 2-terabyte portable USB drive. We will have an online poll. Board members are not eligible for this prize, so it is members only and regular members only, and we will have an online poll for the best presentation, and whoever gets the highest numbers will win that 2-terabyte portable USB drive. So something a little bit different. If you're interested, send in a message to suggestionbox@opcug.ca and with a brief description, title and brief description, and we'll give you a time slot at the September meeting. And with that, the queue will now be open for Q&A for next week. And so if you have any shares, questions, et cetera, by all means, send them into that email address, and we'll take them in the order received and queue things up for next week's meeting. So thanks very much, folks, for attending, and hope you have a good week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
You can stop the
Yeah, I will stop
recording now, Chris.
Yeah, thank you. And...